The following message was recorded at the No Regrets Men's Conference. More information about the conference is available at noregretsconference.org. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission.
Welcome to No Regrets, and I hope you guys had a great time in the early session. This is the Coaching U Sports breakout session. Speaker is Ralph Moreau. He has two adult children. Been married almost 27 years to his lovely wife, and currently is serving as the area director for the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. So he's going to give us a little wisdom on coaching youth sports. And so here's Ralph.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
I want you to do me a favor. When you fill out your comment card that Steve asked, if you hear anything in here this morning that's helpful to you, put a little note on and say there should have been a larger room for this topic. And I just say that because I mean I've spoken at No Regrets for years and years and years and years. They know me well. They asked me to do certain topics, and this year they asked me to do this one in a small room, and then the two next hours I'm going to be doing real brothers, friendship, male friendship, in a large room twice. And I asked them to just swap this so we could have a larger room, and they said no. So anyhow, it's a passion of mine. Obviously, I'm biased. I work with the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. I work in the realm of athletes and coaches all the time. I think it's a hot topic, and I think it should be treated as more of a hot topic here when we gather all these men together. So anyhow, excited to be here. I'm just going to give you a warning. I have far more material than we have time for this morning. We just discovered that I have a speaker's paradise. The clock back there has stopped. So I have unlimited time. I know that that's not true. We will stop on time. And we'll get as far as I can go with the material. I put my email up here. I hope this just, you know, that I can be a resource for you. That's what I do in my ministry and in my life. And I love talking about coaching. And what I'm going to share with you today is largely philosophical, which means it's a lot of ideas. And I'm sort of convicted after Crawford says it's not about what you think, it's what you do. So, but the ideas are meant to spur you on to do something in your coaching. But if you get to the point of just wanting to bounce some ideas off or want more practical, and we don't get to that today, please continue the conversation with me via email. I would love to do that for you.
And this isn't about beating his own defense?
No, it is not about beating his own defense. So anyhow, but I'm excited to be here with you. I'm excited that you're here for a couple reasons this morning. One is because I'm one of you. I'm a coach. I've coached at Brookfield Central since 1987 in the boys' basketball program. Along the way, during that same time, I had the opportunity to coach both of my kids in a variety of sports in the recreational level. So that's not the elite AAU level, just the recreational fun level. So I've coached for a long time. And any time I'm around coaches, I get fired up. Because I love coaching. I love talking about it. I love sharing ideas. I love hearing feedback. And so one reason I'm excited to do this with you all is because I know that I'm getting something from you. You're spurring my passions. You're going to stir up my coaching juices. And if we interact even a little bit, it's going to help me. And so I thank you in advance for that. But the second reason I'm excited is because I believe what the research says about you. And this is what this says about you. It says that you, youth coaches, are the most influential people in the lives of our adolescents in our culture today. And I want to tell you, I'm a living example of that. Because when I was in junior and senior high, my coaches were the most influential people in my life, except possibly my parents in a few areas. But they impacted my life. And I'm so thankful that I had two high school coaches that stepped into my life in a significant and effective way. And they saw something, they poured into my life, and they saw something in me that I didn't see back then as a young man. And they helped me develop qualities and characteristics and values that I carry with me even today, some 40 years later. And so when I look out at you, I realize that every one of you has that same opportunity to pour into the lives of the athletes that you'll work with at whatever level you're working at, making a deposit in their life that they could carry with them for the rest of their life. How exciting is that? It's truly exciting. But can I level with you? Back in 1987, when I started as a rookie coach at Brookfield Central, I didn't know what I was doing. I had passion, and I had dreams, and I had ideas, but I really didn't know what I was doing. And when people asked me what my philosophy was, what my emphasis was, what my approach was to coaching, I struggled to put into words, but I eventually settled on something like this. Well, I'm trying to coach the hearts of my athletes, not just their bodies. And that sounds good, doesn't it? But then they'd ask the next question. So how are you doing that? And I just have to shrug my shoulders and say, well, I'm not sure. It's all trial and error at this point. Oh, what I would have given to have way back then in the start of my coaching career, all the resources that are available today to me. And particularly, I'm going to start right now, pause, and give you a little commercial, because we're not going to be able to cover everything that I think is the best resource out there right now for coaches. It's called three-dimensional coaching. I happen to be a certified presenter of it because I think it's so important and impactful. But if I was to try to do that today, I would just frustrate you because I could just scratch the surface with it, and you would be angry at me that we even tried to do it, because it takes a couple hours to really develop and introduce it to you. So I'm offering a follow-up seminar to this one in about a month here at Elmbrook, March 12th, and Bob has some sheets here. There's also sheets down at the FCA table down there that you can grab one, because you would need to sign up in advance because there's limited room. There is a slight cost to it. But if you don't get a sheet and you're interested and want more information, contact me with this. So that's, and it's called three-dimensional coaching. It's talking about coaching at different levels. I'll just tell you briefly what it is. There's the three dimensions are the physical, which is the body, the skills, the strategies. I mean, it's the part that I really love to sit and talk with other coaches about, breaking zone defenses, all those kind of things. I love that. That's in the physical. Then the second one is the mental, the psychological. It's things like confidence and motivation and teamwork and team cohesion. It's really in that area that coaches are struggling and athletes are struggling at this point in our history. Because you can go on the website and find literally thousands of help in the first dimension, the physical, the strategies. But when you go to the second dimension, people are struggling because, you know what, athletes are different today than they were even 10 years ago because of the culture that we're living in and how fast it's changing and what they have to deal with and what they're consumed with. But then the third dimension is what I'm excited about. That's the dimension of the heart, the soul, the core of their being. It's things like significance and purpose, and it's helping athletes deal with those kind of things. We're at the forefront of dealing with that at Brookfield Central because just last week we had a funeral right here at Elmbrook for a young athlete who by every outward appearance, had everything going for him, and he chose to end his life like that. And so coaches who have been trying to do what I do, pour into his life and impact his heart, somehow we missed something for that young athlete. And so it's an adventure that we challenge coaches to get on, because we also tell coaches that if you want to coach in all three dimensions, you've got to be taking care of all three dimensions in your own life. And you've got to make sure you're on an adventure to do something with your heart. Something like what Crawford talks about this morning. Because as one of my colleagues says, it's hard to be a tour guide to a land you've never visited. And so if you want to impact kids' hearts in a positive way, you have to make sure that your heart is positive too. And so that's what that seminar is all about. That's just the commercial. Let's jump into what I'm going to do today. And you're going to get bits and pieces of it, but not in the same format, because I'm going to try to share with you my philosophy. I think at its best, coaching is a ministry. And I say that not to make it real spiritual. I mean, I coach at Brookfield Central. It's a public school. I actually have a dad of one of my athletes this year here, and so he knows. I mean, I don't preach. I don't share Bible verses. I live my life in front of them. And the way I choose, the choices I make, and the drills I do, and how I try to motivate them, and whatever, I try to do it in such a way that I'm ministering to their life. And what that means is that I'm helping them live the right way. Yes, I'm hoping that they play the right way, but beyond that, I'm hoping that they live the right way. So let me just, my definition of ministry is helping people live life God's way. And whenever we teach someone to live life God's way in any aspect of their life, we're helping them to live God's way in their life. And, you know, as Crawford says, we compartmentalize a lot. And so my challenge in coaching is to take the compartmentalization of the basketball court and broaden it to life in general. And it's not an easy thing to do, but it's a fun thing to do. And it's exciting when you see it happening. I mean, living life God's way, it's bringing God into view, experiencing a personal God who cares about us. It's understanding love and grace. It's the importance of obeying Him and living by His principles, however you package those principles. Whether you package them leading with a Bible verse or you just simply package them with maybe a basketball principle. It's demonstrating how God's love flows from my life, flows into my life, and then flows out into their lives as well, and it's challenging. My key verse for this whole deal is 1 Timothy 4:7-8. Rather, train yourself to be godly, for physical training is of some value, but godliness has value for all things, holding promise for both the present life and the life to come. What I love about this verse is when I started out getting into sports ministry, I had a lot of people sort of questioning the value of sports ministry because there's a whole slew in the world of Christianity that thinks that sports and athletics is a waste of time. It's trivial. How important can it be? And I love it because, you know what? The Apostle Paul is on my side in this. He says physical training is of some value. I love that. As an athlete, as a coach, it validates what I'm doing with my life because physical training has some value, but it's limited. It has value for this life. But what Paul does, which I love, is he kind of weds it together with godliness, and he says godliness is good for all time, both this life and the life to come, and he puts them together. And he says, if you can use physical training, which has some value, to teach godliness, which has value for all times. And that's really the challenge that I see in coaching. So coaching models are all over the map today. Vince Lombardi, Bill Belichick, Rex Ryan, Ron Rivera, Tony Dungy, Bobby Knight, John Wooden. I mean, they're all over the map. So the question that I have for you is, who is it that you have in your mind's eye as a model coach? The coach that you want to be like. The coach that you want to learn from. Because we all do it. We all see them. We hear about them. Who has shaped your idea of coaching? It's really important to know, a little bit like what Crawford says. What's in your mind oftentimes will flow then into how you act and what you do and all those kind of things. And so here's where we're going today. We're going to look briefly at the culture of sport today, because that impacts all of us. We're then going to look at the benefits of sports. We're going to look at some biblical principles to consider in your coaching. And if we have time, we'll get to a couple of practical how-tos. The clock says I'm still just not even started yet, so that's good. So here we go, the culture of sport today. Our culture today, our sports culture, is inundated with a win-win-win mentality. And it's this obsession with winning is absolutely devastating to our young athletes. Now, I want to just tell you, there's probably not a more competitive guy in the room than me. And I've never played a game yet where I've tried to lose. So I'm not saying that winning isn't a part of the whole sport, but what we've done in our sport culture, and I'm saying we because we've all bought into it somehow, some way, we have somehow said that winning is the only measure of success. We are saying that if you win, you have value. If you lose value. That's what our culture is saying because of this win-win-win mentality. I remember listening to the Mike and Mike on ESPN a number of years ago, I think probably now. It's probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. And they were talking about all the great coaches. and they're talking about coaches, and they're trying to rate the coaches. And then one of them, I don't remember which one, but one of them says this. Well, you know, the bottom line, though, is it always comes down to winning. But is that really true? Is that really true? Is the bottom line really only about winning? I remember the year when the Green Bay Packers went to the Super Bowl. You know, they just barely got into the playoffs. Remember that? I mean, they had to win out, and they did, and there were exciting games. And then the playoffs, they had to go on the road and win every one of the games. And then they got to the Super Bowl, and I was listening to sports call-in shows, and caller after caller after caller called in and said, but if they don't win the big one, it's a lost season. Are you kidding me? Is that where we've gotten to? That the only way that it's a decent season is if you win it all? I'll tell you what, there's a pretty short list at the top, isn't there? And if we're saying that that's the only place where there's value and success, maybe we shouldn't be in it at all. Because it's almost worse than the lottery in terms of coming out on top. So this win-win-win mentality is not healthy, and it's eating our kids up. Psychologist Elliot Anderson says this: the American mind in particular has been trained to equate success with victory, to equate doing well with beating someone. And in his book, Kids in Sports, Pastor Bill Perkin says it this way: when we view others only as competitors, we reduce them to obstacles standing in our way of victory. We forget that they are human beings with disappointments, desires, hurts, and needs. I've seen parents, players, and coaches totally dominated by their desire to win. We must constantly remind ourselves and our children that there are things in life more important than winning. A couple years ago, we had Tim Mastey and his wife Amanda as our guest speakers at our FCA big event that we do called the Winner's Dinner, and I had the opportunity to interview them in front of the group, and I had a delightful time getting to know them before we went out on the stage to be interviewed. But in the interview, we were talking, and I don't know even what the question was, but Amanda at one point said, you know, Ralph, I have learned to never hope against another kicker or punter because I realize that they are someone's husband. And I've watched the pain and anguish that Tim lives with if he feels like he hasn't been successful and he somehow let his teammates down. You see, that's a great perspective. Because instead of just hoping that somebody else will miss the field goal, she won't go there. Because she knows that's a person. It impacts lives. And there's something more important than just that winning field goal. It's life in general. One veteran youth coach facing this win-win-win mentality expressed it this way: win now is killing kids. Why do we have to win now in first grade or in fifth grade or in ninth grade? What's the urgency? And yet so many times coaches and programs, you find these catchy little slogans and they put them on the back of T-shirts. And one of them that's very, very popular is win now. Win now. Joe Erman in his very good book, Transformational Coaching, says this: there is a distinct difference between the desire to win and the need to win. And there's everything good and healthy about the desire to win because it's part of the integrity of the game. The team that scores the most points wins, and so it's part of the strategy, it's part of the excitement, it's part of the journey. But the need to win, to validate yourself, is unhealthy and dangerous. And there's, you know, a fine line. So that's the first thing. Second thing is specialization. Year-round training at younger and younger and younger ages. It's eating our kids up. Wes Clutchin, who is the U.S. Olympic wrestling coach, says this: there's only so many matches in each kid. He's talking about wrestlers. There's only so many matches in each kid, and we're using them up too early. Last night on my way home from, we had a game last night, and the families and some of the coaches went out to just have a bite to eat and sort of celebrate, and we were out there. And on my way home, driving home, I happened to throw on WTMJ, and Clark Howard was on, which usually he's talking about money stuff, but he was interviewing John Smoltz, who is a Hall of Fame pitcher for the Atlanta Braves. And John was talking about this. I don't even know. He must have some program or something that he's doing, because Clark was asking him and thanking him for this huge impact. Because Clark says, I've been concerned about this specialization thing for a number of years, but I'm not an athlete, so I have no credibility. But you are an athlete. And John said, yeah. He said, I am so glad I grew up in Michigan where I couldn't throw a baseball year-round. He said, because it would have ruined me. And then he talked about his own kids and how a couple of them have played soccer since they were really, really little. And by the time they were old enough to go where they wanted to go, their bodies were destroyed because of all the soccer year-round. And the specialization is eating us up. There's only so many matches that kids can play. There's only so much they can do. And, you know, I'm a dinosaur. When I was in high school, I played football, basketball, track, and baseball. Without knowing it, I was cross-training, because I switched from sport to sport to sport to sport. I still have an artificial hip because of all of my playing. My body wore down. But had I played only one of those sports, it would have wore down far sooner. One of the things I'm seeing is our kids. I mean, the kids I'm coaching. I mean, some of these kids I'm coaching this year in ninth grade, last year as eighth graders, played 40, 50, 60 basketball games. And this year they only get to play 20 at the high school level. You know, and they're being forced to go year round. And it's not good, it's not healthy. And you talk to any orthopedic doctor around, and he'll tell you, kids are doing too much for too long periods of time. Their bodies can't recover. They're not ready for that. The third thing then is the elite athlete syndrome, and it's prevalent. And that's identifying at an early age the special athletes. And, you know, those that are the ones that get on the every AAU team, and people are after them, and they're the special kids, the special athletes, and we're trying to identify them earlier and earlier and earlier. And what the danger of that is that they start learning pretty early on that ordinary rules don't apply to them. And if we need, I mean, there's all sorts of examples of it. A few years ago, Tiger Woods was an example of it. Right now, Johnny Manziel is a prime example of it.
How about Brian Weideman, who NHL guy who cross-checked the referee of the game the other
day? Yeah, I mean, we see it all over the place. They grow up as special elite athletes. They think that the normal rules for everybody else don't apply to them, and they get all out of whack, and that's happening. You know, the reality is that 1 out of 10,000 high school athletes become professionals. And yet the promise in AAU particularly, and again, I'm not totally against AAU, but there's a lot of corruption in AAU. There's a lot of adults in it for themselves and not for the kids. There are some good people in there, and there's some good involved in AAU and programs like that. But the promise is, play in our program and we'll get you a college scholarship. Play in our program and we'll get you to the pros. And it's a lie to most of the kids that are playing today. I mean, 1 out of 10,000 high school athletes become professionals. You know how unique it is for us at Brookfield Central? We have Joe Thomas playing for the Cleveland Browns, and this weekend, Brad Nortman is going to be punting for the Carolina Panthers if they ever have to punt. And they will against Denver. They will. They both made it to the pros. They both were kids that I got to coach. But you know what? I didn't coach them in football. I coached them both in basketball. They were both multi-sport athletes until a certain point when they made their decision to concentrate on the one that they made it that way. Have you ever paid attention to the NFL? How many of the elite tight ends didn't play college football? They played college basketball. Multi-sport. And it's really important. So elite athlete syndrome, we got to be careful. Do you know what the average NFL career is? Just take a guess.
6 years.
3 years, right on the nose. 3.1 years, and it's an old stat, so it might be different. And we don't understand that because we have guys like Brett Favre and Donald Driver and Aaron Rodgers who are around forever, and we think that's the norm, and it's really not. So even out of that 1 out of 10,000 that makes it to the pros, some of them only last for a year or two or whatever. And so, you know, we've got to be careful with that. And then there's the trend toward moral decay in athletics. One sociologist said this way, the default mode in sports is moral breakdown rather than character building. And part of it is driven by the win-win-win mentality, because anything is okay as long as it's leading towards winning. And it just breaks down. And Robert Lightside, who did a study, says the study seemed to indicate that the athletes are less ethical than other students. The current moral climate in and out of sports is a powerful opponent, perhaps especially for someone trying to win with honor, decency, and a respect for the game itself. And we see it all over the place. Now, all that is not meant to discourage you, but it's meant to help you have a realistic view, because you know what? Your kids are in this culture. The kids that you're coaching are growing up in this culture. They're impacted by social media. They're impacted by Mike and Mike. They're impacted by all sorts of things. I mean, I had a kid in the locker room last year who we came into the locker room, did our postseason, post-game thing, and everybody else left, and I went around just checking to see how we were in a visiting locker room, just checking to make sure that we didn't wreck the place, and I come around the corner, and the kid's sitting there crying. And he's one of my starters. And I said, well, I won't use his name. I'll call him X. X, what's wrong? What's up? And he goes, I was just texting all of my AAU buddies, and they all asked me how many points I had tonight. And you know, I only had 4, and they're all in double digits, and And I'm like, I looked at him, I said, X, we won. And he was down in the dumps. You know, that's the world the kids live in. They're hearing things. They're listening. Things are bombarding them. And they're living in this culture, and we need to understand it. So what are the benefits of sports then? Well, it helps us celebrate life. I mean, it really does. It helps us celebrate life. The whole reason that most of us and most of the kids started playing games was because they were fun. And they enjoyed it. And it was a celebration of life. Secondly, it helps us discover our gifts and abilities. It helps us have a self-understanding of our personalities and even some of the special giftedness we have, and in some cases, the giftedness we don't have. And you know, I know that because at the freshman level, my goal is try to develop and help every one of the kids be able to move to the next level. In our case, it's the JV, if they want to. And you know what? That process of our freshman year, it weeds out some of the kids. Because some of the kids decide they're not committed to it. Some of them decide, maybe I'm not gifted at this. A number of years ago, I had a kid that played for me as a freshman. It was way back when I started at Central, because I spent 5 years at the freshman level, then I did 17 years at the varsity level, and now I'm back at the best level, the freshman level, again. And so there I'm then, but way back when I had a kid, when I first started, that played for me as a freshman, and he realized he wasn't that good dribbling the basketball. He's a terrific athlete. He ended up changing to wrestling and became an all-state wrestler. He might never have figured that out if he wouldn't have tried basketball. Basketball looked like more fun than wrestling, but he had more success in wrestling and ended up really loving it. So it helps us discover our gifts and abilities. 3, that leadership development can happen within a sports context. You know, it's not an accident that a lot of corporate execs look for former athletes to interview for their companies because there's leadership qualities that can come out with being involved in sports. The whole concept of teamwork, learning the value of being on a team, working together for a common purpose. You know, I tell my parents at our parents' meeting that my goal as a coach with 15 or 16 freshmen, whatever I choose to keep this year, it's 15, with the 15 freshmen is that I want this year to be a positive experience for them regardless of playing time. And that's foreign language in the culture today. But honestly, I say to my parents, I believe being a part of a team has value. regardless of playing time. And you know what? I have to work hard to instill that idea to my players, because they quickly go with the cultural norm that if I'm not playing, I'm not valuable. And so it's a hard thing, but learning teamwork and how do you get individual athletes who are being told over and over again that they can get to a certain level and they can get a scholarship, and how do you get them to be all about we when everybody else is saying it's all about me? It's a hard thing. But you know what? Anybody that's truly successful in life has learned what being on a team is all about. The marriage team, the family team, the business team, the neighborhood team. I mean, we use teamwork all over the place, and we need to learn how to do that. Fifth, discipline and a work ethic. To be successful in sports, like anything, it takes commitment, it takes discipline, it takes working at it. And that's a value that can be helpful far beyond the athletic field. Sixth, we can learn persistence, dedication, determination, a stick-to-itness versus the instant gratification that our culture promises over and over and over again. It helps us to be able to learn that value. It helps us learn to handle adversity. An illustration, this is an old number, probably 3 years old. And in this day and age, this is an old number. But research tells us that the average person faces 27 adversities every day. That means 27 things that go different than the way we thought or planned. So 27 curveballs thrown at us on the average. Back in the 70s, it was 15 a day. I'm guessing that if I had a current one, it would be in the 30s to 40s range, because life is moving so fast. And sports, if you play sports, things happen that are out of your control. You can control some things, but things happen. An opponent does something. An official makes a call that you don't like. A coach makes a decision you don't understand. I mean, it can help us learn how to deal with adversity when life kind of throws a curveball at us. How do we handle that in a positive way? How do we handle the frustration that brings? And then eighthly, it raises our compassion index. Seeing life and feeling life from somebody else's perspective. See, I tell my parents that my goal, and I can do this more easily on the freshman level than I ever could do on the varsity level, but my goal is to play every kid in every game. I'll just come clean. It hasn't happened. It's my goal, and I tell the parents that, but then I also tell them that it probably won't happen, because there's lots of complexities involved in that. One, the opponent can sometimes dictate that, because sometimes it's just not the best for some of the kids that aren't ready to play at a certain speed or a certain level to throw them in against somebody that's way above them. Another one is how hard are the kids working every day in practice? And if they're not working hard in practice, then I'm going to reward the kids that are playing in practice. And so there's a lot of that. But one of the things that happens when I do play everybody is those stars that are used to being out there impacting the game find out what it's like to be sitting on the bench watching their teammates controlling the game. And that builds compassion. Because it's pretty easy to like the game of basketball if you never come off the floor. But if you realize, in our situation, 2/3 of my team is not playing in any given game at a certain time. And yet, if they're really valuable, they need to learn that their position, even on the bench, can be of value. And it's a tough thing to do, but so I've got to rotate the guys around. I remember in the youth leagues, I used to play my all-star shortstop. I used to play him in right field once in a while. So he learned what life was like when the game was boring instead of when he was in every play. And that's a good thing, because you know what? Life is that way sometimes. All right, so here's some principles to consider. That clock still hasn't moved. I better look. Okay. Principles to consider. Applying biblical principles to your coaching. The first one is this. What's in you spills out on others. What's in you spills out on others. Your past has prepared you for your present. FCA Vice President Dan Britton likes to say it this way: hurt people hurt people. And I'll just tell you that, I mean, already this year, I've had a couple of days where I brought stresses from my life and some things that were happening outside of the basketball court, I've brought them to the basketball court, fully determined to not let them seep out, and boom, something happens, and whew, the kids get it. Now, having said that, it's also a great opportunity for them to learn something about life and being a man, and so I own up to it. And I tell them it was inappropriate or what's happening. And in one case, I even told them what was going on outside that I tried to block out, but I couldn't, and they end up paying a price for what I was dealing with. And so we've got to understand, Matthew 12, 33 to 35 says, the good man brings good things out of the good stored up in him. And so what's in us spills out. And so much like what Crawford talks about, what are we doing? Where are we settling ourselves? What are we choosing to do for our heart? Luke 6:45, Mark 7:14 through 23, those are all in that same idea. In Proverbs 4:23, it talks about heart care. It says, above all else, before you do anything else, if you're only going to do one thing, do this. Above all else, guard your heart, because it's the wellspring of your life. What's in us spills out on others, whether we're trying to hide it or not. If Jesus is alive in our heart, he'll spill out on others. And that's where I think coaching can become the best kind of ministry. When we become living examples and Jesus is spilling out of us just because of who we are. Second principle then is this: your philosophy impacts your actions. Crawford hit that a little bit. I mean, really the whole idea is belief should determine behavior. And so your philosophy will impact your behavior, will impact your decisions. It will create the kind of coach that you are. Can I just ask you, just out of curiosity, how many of you have written down your coaching philosophy? Okay, some of you have. That's great. How many of you have a coaching philosophy? You all do. Whether you wrote it down or not, you have a coaching philosophy. Because if you coach, you have a philosophy. You have a belief system. There's something you're making decisions on. And so we do all have an idea of what coaching is supposed to be like. But we need to think about it, sort of be intentional about how we're going to do it, why we're going to do it, all those kind of things. 1 Timothy 4:15 through 16 says this: watch your life and your doctrine closely, because if those two match up, it will be really beneficial for you and for all of the people watching you. But if they don't match up, careful, caution. I like to use this illustration. It's sort of an old one now, because I don't know if it happens that much anymore, but used to be back when I was growing up. You watch the TV, every once in a while there'd be an older movie on, and the picture would not quite jive with the words. And so the people were moving their mouth at a different time that the words were coming out on the screen, so you were hearing something, but the picture wasn't exactly lining up with the audio. You know what the research would tell you? That when that's happening, the people ignored the words, they watched the picture. So what that says is, we can talk a good talk, but if we're not walking a good walk, it's probably not near as effective. That if we're talking the talk and walking the walk, then that's beneficial both to us and to our hearers. So your philosophy will impact your actions. You know, in dealing with a lot of coaches, I usually, when I ask coaches, you know, why they're in it, what got them into coaching, most of the time the answer I hear is, I'm in it for the kids. I'm in it for the kids. I'm just in it for the kids. And I'll just be brutally honest with you. When I go and watch some of these coaches, I know that that's a lie. Because the way they coach, they're not in it for the kids. And so our philosophy will impact the way we coach. Do you know what a survey says why most kids play sports? Top three reasons: to have fun, to improve skills, and to make friends. But you know those same surveys, you know what they say about the kids that are quitting at early and earlier ages, by the way? The top four reasons are lack of playing time, lack of success, they're having no fun, too much criticism. And so it's important to kind of understand that and know that because it can help you just kind of put your philosophy together. A number of years ago, doing a seminar like this, a guy came up and said, "Hey, you know what? Is this something like this helpful?" And he showed me. He was coaching a group called the Ramblers. That was their name. New Berlin Ramblers or wherever he was from, the Ramblers. And so he just did this for core values to try to help the kids and help himself to know what was important. The R stands for real fun time. A, all-out effort. M, make the team better. B, be a good sport. L, learn the basic skills. E, encourage each other. R, repeat the basic skills. S, success means improvement. And he said that he brings that out, you know, occasionally during the season, just reminds them. And then he chooses drills to do to try to reinforce all those. So our philosophy, our beliefs will impact our behavior. Thirdly, your words are powerful. Our words as coaches are so powerful. And probably a number of years ago when my daughter was pretty little, she was involved in a camp. And it was an art camp. And she had been telling her art teacher that she liked art camp just almost as much as basketball camp. And then, you know, what basketball camp do you? Well, my dad did a basketball camp. And she said, "Well, I'd like to meet your dad sometime." So when I picked her up from the last day, Leah said, "Dad, come on in and meet the teacher." And so I came in, and so trying to build Leah up, and Leah was just young, she goes, "Well, so Leah, tell me, what does your daddy do for a living?" And Leah looks with a big smile on her face. She goes, "My daddy talks for a living." And it was cute, but it convicted me because it reminded me how powerful my words are, because I do talk for a living. I talk at places like this. I talk to coaches one-on-one. I talk to my athletes every day at practice. And my words are powerful. Proverbs says it this way: reckless words can pierce like a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. And I'm going to tell you where my reckless words come. My reckless words come when my life is filled with stress. My reckless words come when I don't open up the Word of God in the morning. My reckless words come when I'm in a hurry and I'm late for practice. My reckless times come when I'm frustrated with my relationship with my son and I let it flow into my relationship with my players. I mean, my reckless words can come and bombard me if I'm not careful, but when I'm wise, I can use pretty good words. Okay, and it goes back to then the Proverbs 4, above all else, guard your heart, because it's the wellspring of life, because you know what? My heart is the wellspring of my words, too. And so, reckless words can really be damaging, but good ones can be great. And I would just challenge you when you think about your words, that motivation. Think about encouraging words versus shameful words. The overwhelming tone in coaching is shameful words. I'll give you an example. My son, who is not necessarily a gifted athlete, was playing soccer on a soccer team for the first time. It was, I'm thinking, fourth grade. Most of the kids that were playing on that team had played since they were in second grade. So he was probably 2 years behind. We went to the first practice, and I just sat in the car just to watch, see what would happen, see how bad it was going to be. And they did a bunch of things with the ball, and every time they did something with the ball, Jamie really struggled. And then every once in a while they would do something without the ball, just running and whatever, and then he was fine. He was right, just one part of them. But at the very end of the practice, they did what was wind sprints dribbling the ball. And he was terrible. And he came in last on every single one of them. And I wondered, and I saw the coach talking to him, I just wondered what the coach was saying. I didn't know. Jamie gets in the car, and I said, "Well, hey, how was it?" He goes, "Dad, I'm a terrible soccer player." And I said, "Well, why do you say that?" "My coach says so." So the next practice, I talked to the coach. As a loving, caring dad and a Christian man. Seriously, it was a good conversation. He said, well, Ralph, I was just simply trying to motivate him. And I said, do you realize that shame is probably one of the worst motivators you can use? And we had a great discussion. And you know what? I truly think that he made decisions to change. I've caught it myself doing it. I've caught myself a number of years ago when I started looking at shame because, you know what, for me, shame sticks to me like I'm wearing Velcro. It's one of my ongoing life challenges. Somewhere in my childhood, and I think I could put my finger on some of the sources of it, but some of them were coaches, some of them were family members. There were people that were really good at trying to use shame to motivate me, and I believed them. And so when I get shamed, it sticks to me like Velcro. So when I hear something about myself, I automatically think that I'm a bad person. That's what shame does to you. And so I'm very, very hypersensitive as I've done this journey through shame. I actually found it, discovered that about myself a few years ago when I went through some grief counseling when I lost a family member and just was in just struggling and found out that I had this deep battle with shame. And so I'm hypersensitive to shame. And so I'm in coaching one of my teams, and I line them up to do a running drill, and just a normal running drill. And I say, come on, Joe, don't be last. That's shameful. It's subtle, but it's shameful. Because you know what? Joe was last. And he usually was last. And the absolute truth of it was, even if he did his best, he was going to be last. So how motivating is that for me to tell him, don't be last? What that says to him, don't be yourself. You're not good enough. We got to be careful. Our words are powerful. Here's some that you can look to help you out. Hebrews 10:24. Ephesians 4:29. I'll slow it down there. Proverbs 15:23. Proverbs 12:25. Proverbs 16:24. You might see there's a lot of Proverbs in there. I mean, I've done a spiritual exercise for probably 15, 16, 17 years. And that is I read the proverb of the day. You know, there's 31 of them, so if I don't ever know what to open my Bible up to, I open up to the proverb of the day. Hebrews 10:24. Ephesians 4:29. Proverbs 15:23, Proverbs 12:25, and Proverbs 16:24. And again, I just read the Proverbs because I heard way back when Billy Graham said that he reads a psalm, a proverb, and a gospel every single day. He reads a psalm because it lifts his eyes and his heart and his mind toward God in heaven. He reads a proverb because they're so practical, he can always find something that he can apply that day. And he reads a gospel because he wants to be like Jesus, and the gospels are all about Jesus. And I kiddingly have said, well, I figured I was about one-third about as spiritual as Billy Graham, so I grabbed on to the proverb of the day. And really, literally, I have read a proverb of the day for the last 15 years. Now, I've missed a few days here and there. But you know what's amazing to me, guys? Really, honestly, you know, I talk about this all the time. The Word of God is living and active. That's what it says about itself. It means it's not just a good old book. It means that it's still something that God uses in our life. After 15 years, 12 months in each one of those years, a proverb of days, so reading through them all those times, I'm still finding proverbs that are new to me. Isn't that amazing? Or else I'm just a slow learner. But it's the Word of God comes alive. And Billy Graham was right. I find something in a proverb every single day that I can apply that day. And one of the areas is my speech. My words are powerful. Your words are powerful. Fourthly, measuring success. How do you measure success? Effort versus performance-results. It's tricky for players and for teams. 1 Corinthians 9:24 is that great little passage that Paul uses as an illustration. He says, don't you know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets a prize? You have to get the prize. That's not what it says. That's what our culture says. what Paul said was, don't you know in the race all the runners run and only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. He's talking more about the effort, the journey, and how you go about it. And how do I know that? Because then he goes on, he says, anybody that wants to be in a race like this goes into strict training. They train for it. They work hard at it. And he gets to the end and he says, and then I take a very close look at my life to make sure that I haven't been disqualified when I get to the end. He's talking about the success in life comes in the effort, in the journey, in where we're moving, how we're moving, not in just the final result, not just in the destination point, not just in the result. And so when we're measuring success, how are we measuring that? Are we measuring it in what we do, in wins and trophies and all those kind of things? Or are we measuring in the effort that comes, the journey that comes, the growth that comes, the experiences that we have, the relationships that we build in that course? Mark Johnson, who was a star on that Miracle on Ice team in 1980 in the Olympics. God, thank you. You know, he's featured in that movie Miracle on Ice. You know, he had two of the goals in the team that against the Russian team, and it's a great story, great movie. It's true. You know, the movie is sort of Hollywood version. He even admits that. But interesting thing, he says that the picture of the coach in that movie that they really kind of softened him up. And I don't know if you've ever watched the movie. He's a pretty hard dude. Yeah, they softened him up. So anyhow, but Mark has gone on, besides, you know, scoring those goals and winning a gold medal in the Olympics, he's gone on to coach. He's coached at UW-Madison with the women's team, and they've won several national championships. They're a very, very good program. And he said this, speaking again to one of the events that we had to coaches, he said this: if the only thing people remember about me is that I won a gold medal in the Olympics, or how many championships my teams have won, then my life hasn't been worth very much, has it? Yet in the world of sports, we say, winning it all, that's what it's all about. And I don't know how many of you remember back when Tom Brady won, I think it was his second Super Bowl, they interviewed him on ESPN. And they said, you know, so how was this one compared to the last one? He said, well, I got this one and I thought, is this all there is? Is this all there is? And they just skipped right past that. But he was saying a profound thing. He was saying, is significance and success only winning the Super Bowl? Or is there more to it than that? And I think, what? And deflating footballs, yeah. Well, you may remember John Wooden. You may remember John Wooden. At one point was asked, you know, it actually came, just historical context, it came right after he had Lou Alcindor and then Bill Walton. So he had the two best players on the planet at that time, back to back, and they won all these championships in a row. And finally, he was going to have a normal team that other teams could beat. And the reporters were loving it because, you know, he maybe wasn't going to be the king on the hill anymore. And so they asked him at his, you know, preseason interview or whatever, they said, Coach Wooden, how successful is your team going to be this year? And he kind of looked at him and I think he kind of knew where they were coming from. But he said, well, you know, that sort of depends on what you mean by success. If you're asking me how many games we're going to win this year, we're going to win our fair share. But if you're asking me how successful this team is going to be, come back and talk to me in 20 years, and I'll let you know. You see, Coach Wooden's view of success wasn't winning basketball games. It was teaching young men how to live life, how to live life in a way that was valuable and significant and meaningful. And so he wasn't going to measure the success of a team just based on a silly old record or a championship trophy. He was going to measure it on a number of years and what they did with what they learned while they were with him. Fifth thing is then see players through God's eyes. Value your players. And it's so easy for us to value them only on performance or what they can do for the team. One of the little drills that I do and came through the three-dimensional coaching strategies, I do a one-on-one meeting with each one of my players because I know how easy it is for me, a non-teacher at the school, to only see my players as basketball players. But there's so much more to those guys than just basketball. And so I spend just 20 minutes one-on-one with each one of them, and talk to them, and I ask them silly little questions. Some of them aren't so silly. I ask them about their families. I ask them about school. I ask them about what they do besides basketball, what they like, who are their best friends. Then I ask them silly things like, what flavor of ice cream do they like, or all sorts of goofy things, just because I want to get to know them and value them as more than just basketball players. And so we've got to do that. Psalm 139 says this, fearfully and wonderfully made, is what David says. We're fearfully and wonderfully made. God knit us together in our mother's womb. That's true of every single kid you'll ever coach. See them that way. Find that fearfully and wonderfully made part about them, because it's in there. John?
Sorry to interrupt. Just on that, like, that's true about the kids. Their value comes from God. Coaches, our value doesn't come from the success of our players.
Absolutely.
It comes from God.
Absolutely.
When all of a sudden we start to let our value come from our players, we start to push wins, we start to push success.
Absolutely.
If we keep in mind that our value comes from God and God, we don't have to put that on our kids either.
You're right.
Here's a question I had, too. I'm a first-year assistant soccer coach, ironically, for fourth graders, okay?
Okay.
All right. We were beating one team 11-0. We ended up, and we were pulling back at that point, okay? The opponent's head coach was just going ballistic on his players, on his team. How, as opposite coaches, do we deal with opponents who are negative coaches? Do we do anything...
I think it all depends on your relationship with them. If you have no relationship with them, then you have to control what you can control, and you can control what you do.
Yeah.
A long time ago, a mentor of mine said, Ralph, if you see somebody that's doing it in a negative way, simply be a positive example in front of them. And if your way really is better than his, that might be more of an impact than if you confront him face to face. So it really depends on the relationship. Close relationship, if it's your best buddy, then I think go talk to him.
Yeah.
But if you don't know him at all, just keep coaching in a positive way. So, didn't get to the last one, but guys, it's a great promo for that three-dimensional coaching. We would get into a lot more practical stuff there. If you are interested, check it out. Thanks again.
Thanks.